knives, of course, and what looked like a rather short and skinny sword with a pointed tip. The shields at the end of the rack are excessively curved, as if cupping the body, and seem rather small for, well, shielding.
You wear both at the same time,
Hawk says, answering my unspoken question.
There's a bracer for each shield, and a good bulwark can utilize both at the same time and expand and combine them to provide the most shielding possible for his team.
Ah, I see. I don't, but I'm pretty sure he doesn't want me going toward shields just yet. I move past Meriden, who picks up a spiky-looking club, and take the sword gingerly in hand. It looks, well, stubby. At my side, Gwenna jostles me, picking up a pair of daggers. How come everything is so short?
The same reason you're in a narrow room,
Hawk replies.
You need to learn to fight in close quarters. You're not going to have room to swing a massive sword in a narrow tunnel, so you have to learn to fight with smaller ones. It's why you won't see a full-on quarterstaff or training with a bow and arrow. These are tunnel tactics.
Oh, it makes sense, I suppose. What about a crossbow or a blow dart? He tilts his head and his horns look surprisingly rakish when he does. Not that I'm noticing such things about my new husband.
Are you good with either?
Well, no.
Then it doesn't mucking matter, does it?
Grr! I bite my lip to keep from retorting something impolite. He takes my hand and curls it around the hilt of the sword I'm holding.
You practice with this. Learn the basics. When you master them, then we can talk about other weaponry.
I hold the delicate sword in front of me and wave it in the air, trying to emulate Kip's effortless swings from earlier.
That,
Hawk says, putting a hand over mine to lower it and stop my movements,
is a stabbing blade, not a swinging one, and you're going to put someone's eye out. Let's work on your grip first, all of you. Get a sword and stand in line, and we'll work on the basics.
12. Aspeth. The basics are surprisingly difficult. I'm supposed to hold a sword tightly, but not too tightly. I'm supposed to keep my wrist loose, but not too loose. I'm to stab with expertise, but not slash, and pull back quickly. I'm to avoid bones so my weapon doesn't get caught in them. I'm not to twist or jerk, because I can just as easily snap my own wrist as I can stab a rattling. By the time we're done, my arms are throbbing, and I want to stab Kip with my blade, because the slither skin is a bit of a show-off. It's clear he knows how to do everything already, and I've caught him looking at my grip as I do exercises, an expression of dismay and disgust on his face. So I'm not good with a stabby little sword. I'm positive I have other skills that can be of use. It's fine. Gwenna's good with weapons, though. Just like stabbing a roast that keeps sliding across the pan, she declared confidently as she jabbed a stuffed leather dummy. Or a man who won't shut up. Locke hooted at that. I didn't find it quite so funny, mostly because I'm bollocks at stabbing. I don't like being terrible at things. I prefer to do things I excel at, like reading books and studying ancient languages. The sheer physicality of being a fledgling is starting to intimidate me. I wonder if I've gotten in over my head, if I've made a mistake. But what other options do I have? None. So, I need to stop whining and simply get better at everything. Hawk forces us to lunge and jab, stabbing at the leather dummies until my shoulders and arms ache. My calves ache, too, from all the lunging and the hiking from earlier. By the time we put our weapons away, I'm ready to pass out again.
Break for the evening,
Hawk finally says.
We'll pick up with our hiking at dawn. Be ready.
It's supposed to rain in the morning, Meriden pipes up, her voice timid. It doesn't rain in the caves.
Oh, she's got you there,
Locke crows.
I think I'm hearing a day off.
I think I'm hearing a bunch of lazy students,
Hawk retorts.
Not lazy, Gwenna says. Opportunistic.
Hawk shrugs his big shoulders.
Fine. If you want to avoid the rain, we'll stay in and do weapons practice. You need to learn to fight in low light or none at all, so we'll be using blindfolds.
I groan aloud. Hawk turns to me, quirking that impossibly heavy eyebrow.
Not enjoying practice?
It's fine, I say, determined not to be the problem here. That was a positive groan.
No such thing.
Very much so. I love sword work, I enthuse, lying through my teeth. It was a groan of pleasure. Hawk stares at me. Just stares. Locke grabs Gwenna and Meriden each by the arms.
Let's get out of here before the newly married teacher shows his wife his sword work.
Ew, says Meriden, casting an appalled look in my direction. And I blush, my face hot and my stance awkward. Apparently, talking about groans of pleasure and sword work wasn't the way to handle things. I watch as the others file out of the room. Kip snagging his house and slinging the massive shell over his back before trotting after them. It's just me and Hawk in the room now. Teacher and student. Husband and wife. Definitely not a complication I expected to have. Hawk just continues to stare at me, his gaze hot. He hasn't moved a muscle, but I still feel intensely aware of his scrutiny. It's like he's looking right through my clothing, and it makes me quiver deep inside. I wipe a drop of sweat from my brow. I should go bathe.
You should,
he agrees, voice low and smooth. Nodding, I race out of the practice room and run for the stairs, only to pause. When is it going to get through my head that I'm staying with him and not Gwenna? That I'm married now? Slowly, I turn around and head back toward Hawk's quarters, trying to compose myself. I can do this. It's fine. I enter the room, and I'm relieved to find that it's empty. A short time later, I'm less relieved. How exactly does one bathe oneself? Surely there's an easier way than simply dropping pitcher after pitcher of warmed-up water into the copper tub in front of the hearth. That's entirely too much work, and I'm far too fatigued to even consider such a thing. I stand in front of the tub, with less than a finger of water at the bottom, because two pitchers in, I realize this could take some time, and I don't have the energy for it. Perhaps I can just be grimy and sweaty for the rest of my life. There's a knock at the door. Come in. Hawk enters slowly, his great horned head poking in first. He frowns at me and then closes the door behind him, leaning on it.
Something wrong? I left you time to wash up before I came in.
I put a trembling with fatigue hand to my brow. I'm too tired to fill the tub. I had people do this for me at home.
Of course you did.
I can't tell if he's jeering at me or not, but given how ruthless he is to me in training, I'm going to go with jeering. I'll just stay dirty another day. You did say it would rain tomorrow, yes? That will wash away the grime. Right now, that sounds far better than anything else. He nods, eyeing me.
Wait right here.
As if I have the strength to go anywhere else. I sink into the nearest chair, leaning against the tall back. Sounds lovely. The door closes. I'm nearly asleep when it opens again, and this time Hawk has returned with a massive bucket many times larger than I could possibly manage on my own. He fills the tub for me, and then gestures.
All yours.
Bless you for your kindness. I strip off the sweaty layers of my fledgling uniform and toss them onto the floor, then remove my corset and chemise and cast them aside as well. I step into the tub and sit, my knees against my chest. Before I realize, I just stripped in front of my new husband. I've spent far too many years with servants bathing me, and I didn't even stop to think. I glance up at Hawk to see if he noticed my actions. Oh, he noticed, all right. There's a peculiar look on his bovine face, even though he doesn't say anything. After a moment, he clears his throat and gestures over at me.
You want me to wash your back?
Should I? Part of me does, because there's nothing nicer than being scrubbed by someone else when you're tired. But I don't know what the boundaries are between us, him and I. I don't know, I answer honestly. Is it just washing? He rolls his eyes at me.
It is, unless you want more.
Right now, what I want is a nap and to never see another bag of rocks again.
Well, you won't get either.
He chuckles with a touch of amusement and settles down next to the tub, picking up the washcloth I haven't touched yet.
Sorry, the water's not hot.
After the long, sweaty day I've had, cool water is lovely against my skin. It's fine. I hug my knees. Thank you for the help.
You're my wife. At least for now. It's the least I can do.
What a thoughtful thing to say.
Considering I have to sleep next to you and smell you.
I take it back. All of it I take back. He wets the cloth near my feet, and I'm suddenly very aware of how close he is and how naked I am. Well, married, of course. It's to be expected. But in a few weeks, I'm going to have sex with this man. That was my part of the agreement, and I truly haven't given it much thought. Until now. Now I'm noticing the size of his forearms and the vein that traces along the bulge of one. I'm noticing the warm, reddish-brown of his skin and how he's lightly furred all over, with a thicker pelt going down the front of his chest. I'm noticing that even when he kneels next to the tub I'm folded into, he's absolutely massive. Hawk rubs the cloth across my shoulders, and my fatigue wins over my curiosity about his body. I close my eyes, hugging my legs, and bite back a groan.
I've forgotten how long it's been since I joined the ranks.
He murmurs in a low voice.
The first few weeks under Magpie's tutelage were pure hell.
You weren't in shape. I cannot imagine such a thing.
Oh, I was. But Magpie said that humans were spoiled arses and expected Taurians to be the best of the best. So she pushed me harder than everyone else. She wasn't wrong, either. I can't count the number of times I've had to go in and save a human who wasn't able to hack it. That's why I'm going to push your group hard, Asbeth. It's not out of cruelty. It's out of necessity. You understand, don't you?
I do. I want to learn, and I want to be the best, so just ignore my griping. Everyone else does. I manage a weak smile. When do I get to meet Magpie? He sighs, the sound heavy and defeated.
Soon.
He ditches the cloth, tossing it onto my knee, and then rubs one shoulder gently.
You've got a bruise here.
It takes everything I have not to whimper with pleasure when his fingers dig in. Keep doing that. I'll wash. Hawk grunts and then continues to massage my shoulders, working out all the stress of the last few days. It feels so damned good that I'm barely aware of my surroundings. I want to just close my eyes and lean into his touch and stay there forever. I half-heartedly swipe at my arms and legs, but when he strokes big hands over my back, I give up and just rest against my knees, enjoying the relief. Hawk digs into my muscles, kneading them with expertise.
This isn't going to lead to anything, in case you're worried. You just look like you needed a bit of loosening up.
What would it lead to? I ask with a yawn, my brain in a pleasurable fog. He pauses.
Sex. Your father really did keep you sheltered, didn't he?
Pfft, no, I lie. I don't consider myself sheltered. I had a fiancé once. I let him pet my breasts and caress my thigh. I let him kiss me dozens of times. It's not as if I've never been touched before. But a massage leading to sex? That's ridiculous. No one's ever touched me to massage me except maybe a brisk hand massage from a maid when my fingers were cold. Do a lot of people in the guild massage each other and then have sex?
How would I know? You're the only one I've ever massaged.
Oh. Huh. I wonder if he likes hugs. His thumbs dig into a knot near my shoulder and my lips part. I arch in pain pleasure as he works the tense muscle, and this time I can't help the gaspy noise that escapes me.
Fuck.
Hawk growls. He flings himself away from the tub, storming across the room. I glance over at him, and his tail is flicking back and forth wildly, smacking against the legs of his pants in agitation. I should feel a little guilty, but all I really feel is sad that he stopped. He composes himself while I finish washing with quick, brisk movements, his gaze locked on the wall. When I'm done and I wrap a towel around myself, he turns back toward me.
Remember what I said earlier?
My brows furrow. You've nagged me all day. You're going to have to be more specific than that. I can see him grit his teeth, settling his shoulders.
Don't be dense, Aspeth. You know what I mean. When I said we were going to have an anatomy lesson.
I do remember that. My pussy clenches at the reminder, and I desperately hope he doesn't notice me twitching. You said you didn't want me to have any surprises, that we were going to go over everything prior to the, rutting time.
Good. You actually listened.
His dry humor makes me prickle.
Fine, then. If you've no objections, I'm going to show you what an engorged Taurian cock looks like so you're prepared.
And he unbuckles his belt.
13. Hawk. To her credit, Aspeth doesn't run away the moment I make my announcement about showing her my cock. I feel a little strange about it because it's not in my nature to whip out my genitals to women I've barely met, but we're not going to have much time to prepare for the conquest moon, and we both need to be comfortable. I ignore the lecherous feeling in the back of my mind and cast my belt aside, letting my pants fall to my knees. My cock, already hard and aching, falls out and stands proudly at attention, an arrow pointing directly at my new wife. She blinks at the sight. Blinks again. Squints.
Sorry,
she says after a moment, gesturing nearby at the candles.
The lighting in here is terrible. Can I get a closer look?
I gesture at my length, indicating it's hers to examine as she likes. Aspeth moves closer, still squinting. She leans over and continues to peer, moving so close to my throbbing cock that I could swear I feel her breath. What in the five hills is she doing exactly? She examines me with less than a handspan between her face and my cock, moving back and forth and eyeing me with such focus, as if she's examining a fascinating artifact she's never seen before. It makes me twitch, my tail slapping against the back of my leg. It shouldn't be arousing to watch her stare at me so intently, but I can't help it. Her lips part, and I imagine pushing the bulbous head of my cock between those parted lips, and feeling her tongue brush against my skin. "There's no knot yet," I murmur. "Give me another 3 weeks." Her gaze flicks to me, and then back to my cock. "Well," I prompt, after a long wait, barely holding my breath. Aspeth squints again and then glances up at me.
"I don't mean to alarm you, sir, but you're dripping."
Is that all she has to say? I huff with amusement, shifting on my hooves and resist the urge to stroke my length and watch her reaction to that. Glancing down, I notice the head of my cock is indeed slick with pre-cum. It's because I'm aroused, wife. Don't you get wet when you're aroused? She looks up at me, her face flushing red. Aspeth straightens, touching her nose, and then her hand flutters away. It's a strange motion, as if looking for something and not finding it.
"That is a very personal question, and I won't answer it."
I bite back a laugh at her prudish response. "I'm showing you my cock, Aspeth. We're going to have sex in a few weeks. I think we have to get comfortable with personal questions." She chews on her lip, staring up at me thoughtfully.
"Are you aroused?"
Her voice is soft, husky.
"Right now?"
My cock twitches in response. "Yes."
"Because you just bathed me?"
"Because you're staring at my cock and I'm thinking about fucking you," I admit. "Because I'm thinking about touching your body. I'm thinking about her thick, solid thighs and the softness of her belly. I'm thinking about the heavy weight of her breasts and how they'd feel in my hand. How they'd move in time to each thrust I make inside her. I can't help but think about touching you." Her hand goes to her throat, her eyes soft, her cheeks pink. She wets her lips, gazing up at me.
"Do you need to see me? All of me?"
She gestures at the cradle of her thighs. "I don't need to, but by the five hells, I'd love to." Before I can answer, something crashes in the hall outside and thumps down the stairs. Aspeth jerks in surprise, clutching the towel to her body, and I hastily shove my cock back into my pants.
"What was that?"
she asks.
"An intruder?"
A dish crashes to the floor, followed by a curse, and I wince, shaking my head. "No, I suspect that's Magpie." My new wife brightens. Her fingers go to her mouth, and she bites on her thumb's cuticle.
"Oh, I've been waiting to meet her. How do I look?"
"Like I'm about to fuck you," I want to tell her, but I know the moment is gone. I bite back a sigh of irritation and hold a cloak out to her. "You're wearing a towel."
"Right."
She tosses the cloak around her shoulders and gives a girlish giggle, moving to my side and grabbing my arm.
"Will you introduce us?"
Oh, gods. I could tell her that she doesn't truly want to meet Magpie, that she shouldn't meet her hero, that it's only going to break her heart. But I can't avoid this forever. With an agitated tug on my nose ring, I nod. "Fine. Come on." It's only a few steps down the hall to the kitchen of the house, but each step is incredibly uncomfortable. My cock is throbbing and stiff and shows no signs of receding. I'm glad that Aspeth's too distracted to grab a candle, because the last thing I want is for Magpie to see just how aroused I am. I haven't yet told her that I married one of our students, and I'm not looking forward to that conversation. There's another crash of pans in the kitchen. And when we enter, I see Magpie bent over, digging through one of the larders, knocking dried onions and a wheel of cheese to the ground. A lone candle flickers on the table nearby, providing just enough light for me to see my boss's disheveled appearance. She's wearing a guild uniform, but it's so wrinkled and filthy that I know it's the same one she'd been wearing the last time we talked. A quick glance over at my side shows Aspeth's excitement giving way to confusion. Hells. I clear my throat. Magpie turns to face us, her hair a tangled mess around her head. Her gaze flicks to me, the woman on my arm, and then back to me.
Where's the brew?
I had it removed from the house. You should go to bed, Magpie. She scowls at me and turns back to the larder.
I had a stash here.
Yes, and I removed that too, I say calmly. You said you'd stop drinking.
Tomorrow.
She promises and shoves aside a row of jars, nearly knocking them to the floor. I glance at Aspeth. Her grip on my arm is tight, her face bright as she regards Magpie.
Madame.
She calls out, and then her smile grows broad.
It is such an honor. I've dreamed of meeting you for years. You're the reason I've come to Vast Warren. You're the inspiration that's made me determined to join the guild. You're a legend.
Aspeth's voice grows hushed with awe.
And it is a joy to be one of your students.
I roll my eyes.
One of my students?
Magpie turns, squinting. She seems to notice Aspeth for the first time and then saunters over, weaving in a way that leaves no doubt she's been hitting the bottle hard. No matter how many times I hide the liquor, she somehow finds more. She looks Aspeth up and down, frowning.
I don't know you.
My name is Sparrow.
Magpie barks a laugh in her face, the sound rude and affronting, and my entire spine tightens with the urge to grab Magpie by the arm and march her to bed like a naughty child.
That's not your name, fool.
Magpie laughs, spit flying as she announces this.
You ain't got that name yet, and you ain't my student.
Yes, she is, I say quietly. She's one of your fledglings this year, along with Lark. Her expression contorts, and for a moment I think she's going to apologize. Instead, Magpie leans forward and vomits at Aspeth's feet. Aspeth looks at me with horror and betrayal in her eyes. I feel like an arse because I know she's looked up to Magpie all this time. I should have coordinated a meeting between them, should have figured out a way to gently point out that Magpie prefers to spend her time soused instead of searching for adventure like she did when she was younger. But she's not the same Magpie. Hasn't been for years now.
I really should get to bed.
Magpie says after a moment, straightening and wiping her mouth.
Got fledglings to train in the morning, right after I get another drink.
She wanders away, knocking one of the canned jars to the floor with a crash. Glass and sticky peaches spill all over the floor, and Magpie doesn't seem to notice. I bite back a sigh and pat Aspeth on the shoulder. Go to bed. I'll clean this and make sure she ends up in her bed and not in a gutter somewhere.
She... you...
Aspeth's gaze blinks from me back to the door Magpie pitched herself through a moment ago.
That was...
I know. I give her shoulder a squeeze. We'll talk about it in the morning. Go, sleep.
She's...
a drunk. I know. And that's why we're in danger of losing everything. Now you know why you have to pass this year. If our class fails out, Magpie loses everything. And I do too.
14. Aspeth. 22 days before the Conquest Moon. My hands on my hips, I stare up at Guildmaster Crow, trying to pay attention. It's difficult to be in the moment this morning, because in my head I'm stuck on last night, watching my hero vomit at my feet. Over and over again.
The goal of this drill is to maneuver,
Crow is saying. He clasps his hands together, walking along the wooden beam high above the obstacle course. A thin rain drizzles down on us, turning the dirt course into mud. I hate this. I hate Master Crow. I hate mud. I hate that Hawk cancelled on us this morning, and instead of him training us, we're with strangers as he goes on a retrieval mission. Behind me, a man flicks the hanging edge of my fledgling sash, earning chortles from his teammates. I ignore him, but at my side, Lark growls in her throat. If Guildmaster Crow notices anything, he doesn't acknowledge it. Instead, he points at each section of the obstacle course designed to test our dexterity.
Tunnel, then climb over the boulders, tunnel again, sprint past the falling rocks.
Point, point, point.
Belly crawl under the fallen wall, tunnel again, grab a pack, and then make it across the finish line before the hourglass runs out of grains of sand. If you don't, you'll have to do it all over again.
Not much of a challenge, boss,
calls one of the fledglings.
Maybe we should all be tied together again like yesterday.
He grins over at us, showing off a gap-toothed and evil grin. Monster, Gwenna mutters. I hope your dinner gives you the shits.
Excellent idea, Rosto,
Master Crow says, producing two long lengths of rope.
Master Magpie's team, tie yourselves together. My team, you do the same. We'll have you both on the course at the same time just to keep things interesting.
Oh, they're interesting, all right, Lark mutters. She catches the rope when Crow throws it in our direction and moves toward me. I take it and loop the end through my belt, handing it wordlessly to Gwenna. She watches me with a curious look, but says nothing. We all tie together, Meriden at the end and Kip at the front, ahead of me. Then we march to the starting line, and I squint at the muddy obstacle course as it rains down even harder upon us. The group of men at our side are nudging one another and smothering laughs, no doubt at our expense, but I ignore them. I have to, or else I'm going to start screaming. She's a drunk.
Go!
Master Crow shouts, flipping over the hourglass and setting it down on the beam next to him. Kip races ahead, his pull so strong that I stumble. The team of men alongside us today, Crow's fledglings, push past us, sweeping Kip off his feet and giving me a violent shove. I stumble, and Gwenna catches my arm. What's wrong with you, Aspeth? She whispers. You're not yourself today. If our class fails out, Magpie loses everything. Everything. Everything's wrong. I jerk forward as Kip rights himself and races toward the first tunnel. I stagger after him, getting on hands and knees to crawl through the damp tunnel made of rotting wood and more mud. It narrows down until I have to turn my head to the side and crawl forward using my elbows. But I manage to wriggle through and stand up, only to drip with mud, my boots and pant legs holding an obscene amount of the filth.
Keep moving!
Crow screams at us.
No one told you to stop, Magpie fledglings!
Gwenna sticks a hand out of the tunnel and I grab it, hauling her forward. She collapses on me and pants, waiting for Lark to push through. As we wait, she looks over at me. What's wrong? I shake my head. If I start to vent about how wrong things are, I won't stop. Kip is pulling at the rope, desperate to get to the nearby boulders and continue on the obstacle course. Lark pulls herself through, and then we wait for Meriden. Something's wrong, Gwenna hisses at me. Meriden stumbles toward us, hauled up by Lark's hand, and then we turn toward the boulders. Kip makes an excited sound and races toward them, tugging us along. He skitters up the side of one boulder, taller than a staircase, and then holds his small hand out to me. I take it, and immediately pull him down. Whoops, sorry about that. I set him on his feet. Apologies for the touching. He pats my hand as if to say apology accepted, and then turns back to the boulders. He climbs halfway up the first one, and then watches us, pointing at a ripple in the otherwise sheer surface that might act as a handhold. I put a hand there and try to haul myself up. And fail. And try again. Lark gives my backside a shove. Everyone help out. My face burns with humiliation as the others pitch in and more or less push me up the rock surface, until I'm at the top of the boulder next to Kip and gasping for air. It takes far too long, and I'm sure I'm going to have bruises in unmentionable places, but I'm up there. Put a hand down for me, Gwenna says, reaching up and pressing herself against the boulder's surface. We can do this together. I reach down for her, and Gwenna latches on. Holding on to her threatens to pull me back down, and I yelp in distress as her sweaty hand slips out of mine.
Time!
Master Crow roars. Time already? Locke puts her hands on her hips, glaring off at the distant fledgling group that is already at the far end of the obstacle course. What the mucking fuck? We barely got started. Master Crow claps his hands.
Let's do it again, magpie fledglings. Try to do better this time.
Again? Meriden echoes, her lower lip quivering. He's joking, right? I haul myself up to a seated position atop the boulder and look up at Crow. From the sour expression on his face and the smug ones of his fledglings, no, I don't think he's joking at all. As I watch, one of Crow's fledglings rubs his hands under his eyes, pretending to cry. Another grabs his chest and pretends like he's jiggling his breasts and makes kissy faces as he does. I exhale heavily. Cretins. All of them. Come on, let's get back to the start and put Lark next to Kip. Maybe that will make a difference. No matter how we rearrange our team, we're terrible. By the time the day is over, we're all covered in mud, scratched up, scuffed, bruised, and thoroughly defeated. Even Kip isn't his normal, perky self. The moment we return to Magpie's lodgings, he dumps his shell in the corner and crawls inside, not wanting to socialize with us. I don't blame him. I'm disappointed in us, too. That wasn't training, Gwenna protests as we sit down in the kitchen. That was abuse. At least they helped us wash off before we came home, Meriden says in a timid voice. She sits delicately at one of the seats at the table, manners elegant despite her fatigue. It could be worse. Gwenna makes a face at her. They weren't helping us. They were throwing buckets of water on us because we lost. That was their reward for winning each round of the obstacle course. Yeah, but at least our clothes are cleaner. Locke shakes out her rumpled sash and then thumps down on a chair at the table. She grabs a couple of slices of bread and a wedge of cheese, shoves the wedge between the bread and takes an enormous bite. Why were we training with Master Crow anyhow? He's an asshole. Everyone looks at me. I say nothing at first, because I'm too tired. I'm relievedto see that the nest maid assigned to Magpie's house stopped by earlier today and left fresh bread and snacks out for us, because I don't think I have the energy to get out of this chair and make myself something to eat. I pick one of the nuts out of a bowl decorated with guild designs and nibble on it thoughtfully. Hawk left this morning to go on a retrieval mission. He woke me up before dawn to let me know, dressing quickly in his leathers as another Taurian waited near the front doors to the dorm. He was the one who arranged our training with Master Crow. I believe his exact words were, "He owes me a favor and no one else will have you." But I keep that part to myself. A retrieval mission? Meriden echoes, her dark eyes wide. What's that? Taurian. Locke answers between bites. When she doesn't elaborate, Meriden indicates for her to continue. Locke clears her throat. Taurians are really good in the tunnels. They're strong and sure-footed and have excellent direction sense. They've got an excellent sense of smell, too. And they can keep going when humans get tired. Whenever someone gets lost in the tunnels, they send in a few Taurians to fish them out. Happens all the time. It does? Gwenna wrinkles her nose, glancing over at me. So why don't they just send in teams of Taurians instead of humans? Control, Locke announces.
arrogance and control. Humans want to be in charge of everything. Humans want the artifacts. And there's not enough Taurians in the city anyhow. I think they get tired of our shit and retire after a few years to go live in the countryside and raise little baby Taurians with the lady bulls. She shrugs. It's the guild's dirty little secret. No one has to be as good at surviving in the tunnels as they used to be, because the Taurians will bail them out. Aunt Magpie would joke that passing the test is the hardest part of the job. She opens a sandwich and stuffs another slab of cheese between the bread. I eat a few more nuts before posing a delicate question to her. You knew she was a drunk? Locke makes a face. Everyone knows. Everyone keeps hoping she'll turn it around, but she never does. Why is she like this? I ask, puzzled. She has everything she could want. She's legendary in the guild. She's found some of the most fabled artifacts. The Sword of Starflame, the Claw of Guidance. Legends are going to be sung about her. How can she be miserable enough to try to drown herself in a bottle constantly? Locke takes another large bite of her cheese sandwich and glances over at Meriden. Holders. My hackles prickle with alarm. Gwenna kicks me under the table. You don't say, I manage delicately. Meriden makes a sympathetic noise, then reaches for the cheese to make her own sandwich. She had trouble with a holder? Contract troubles? I know my family can be difficult with negotiations. I've heard the stories. I wait for her to look over at me, to say something about my family, the esteemed and ancient Honori holders that have been in the northern mountains for centuries. But Meriden only nibbles on her sandwich and watches Locke. Locke shakes her head, turning her sandwich and ripping a piece of the crust off with her teeth. Love troubles. She fell in love with a holder's heir. He was using her for her connections and the artifacts she'd find. Magpie always had an amazing sense for locating things, even in the biggest piles of rubble, you know. Incredible things. Some people say she was like Sparkanos the Swan reborn, but with a vagina.
Gwenna clears her throat.
What? I didn't say it. I said some people say it.
Locke shrugs.
Anyhow, Aunt Magpie had everything except the man she wanted. She waited for him to marry her, and waited 5 years or more, I think. Then she found out he was marrying some other holder's daughter. Magpie confronted him and asked him to marry her instead, and he laughed, said she didn't have the right bloodline. I think it broke something in her. She hasn't found anything good since.
Her expression becomes melancholy.
Growing up, my aunt was just the most exciting person I'd ever met. But for the last 10 years, she's been a mess. I'm surprised Hawk hasn't abandoned her. I think he's the only reason she hasn't been booted from the guild. He picks up the slack. He's a good guy.
I nod thoughtfully, eating a few more nuts. He might be a good guy, but he sure is grumpy to me. If there's one thing I can say about Hawk so far, it's that he's protective of Magpie, all right, and determined to help her out. And that means we have to try harder as a team. Tomorrow is a new day, I tell my fellow fledglings. Let's eat and get some rest, and if Hawk isn't back in the morning, we'll have to do that horrid obstacle course again. But at least we'll have a better idea of what to expect. Gwenna groans. Locke does too. Meriden purses her lips and looks ready to cry again. I don't like it either, I tell them, grabbing some of the cheese and slapping it onto some bread. But if this is what it takes to pass, then we just have to conquer it. We'll figure it out, one way or another. We talk for a while longer, eating all the food set out for us and putting away the dishes. Kip joins for a bit, not talking, just listening and nibbling delicately on bits of cheese and bread. Before long, we head to bed, and it makes me feel a little strange to return to Hawk's quarters without him. Squeaker is there, curled up on the bed, and lets out a happy murrup at the sight of me. I wash up and undress, climbing into bed and hugging the cat. Here I'd thought joining the guild would solve all my problems, that I'd coast to graduation and shower my family in artifacts and save the day. Everything is far more complicated than I expected, and twice as difficult. I'm not going to give up, though, even if Master Crow humiliates us daily. It's just going to make my eventual success all the sweeter. 15. Aspeth. 21 days before the Conquest Moon. The next morning, Hawk still hasn't returned. I fight back my disappointment and dress in a fresh uniform, braiding my hair and pinning it up. I desperately want to pull out my spectacles for today, but Master Crow will probably blab all about that to Hawk, and so I don't dare. I'm heading to meet the others when a thunderstorm crackles overhead, the sound loud and terrifying. Gwenna and Meriden are in the hall, cloaks in hand. Meriden peers out a window, watching the rain slash down onto the cobbled streets. We're not going out in this, are we? There's still no sign of Hawk, I tell them. I don't know how long he'll be gone, and we need to make every day count. There's a knock at the door, and Gwenna opens it. A soaked slither skin stands there, his house dripping and his skin bright orange compared to Kip's leaf green. He holds out a folded note and races away the moment she takes it. Gwenna unfolds it and reads it aloud. All classes are to meet at the main guild hall today. No exceptions. She glances up at me. Guess that answers that. Once we're all gathered, we head out into the rain in the guild-assigned waterproof cloaks. They're ugly things, but I have to admit, they do keep you dry. The fledgling nests, the dorms for each guildmaster, are only a few streets over from the main guild hall, and when we arrive, the place is filled with damp students standing in the entryway and talking amongst themselves. There's a ripple of laughter when we arrive, and one of the men grabs his crotch, only for Lark to grab hers back at him. Behave, Gwenna tells her, swatting her arm. I will if he does, Lark protests. Before I can step in, a chime sounds, and everyone looks up to the landing at the top of the hall. Several men with heavily encrusted guild sashes stand up there above us, and I grip my teeth to see that one of them is none other than Rooster.
Today we have an esteemed guest visiting us,
Rooster says in a somber voice.
Archivist Kestrel from the Guild Archives is spending time with us to discuss our next year's plans. We thought what better way to test our new fledglings than to have a little competition amongst our students.
He beams down at us as if he's the most clever man who ever lived.
Please proceed to the artifact training hall when your teacher's name is called.
He glances down at a scroll in his hands.
Masters Thrush and Vulture, please bring your teams in.
What's this? I whisper to Lark. No clue. Showing off? She shrugs. What's in the artifact training hall? Lark blinks at me. Artifacts? Clearly, I'm not going to get anywhere by asking her questions. The teams settle in, waiting in the hall. Mud is all over the gorgeous marble floors, and there are puddles of rainwater by the entrance. I manage to squeeze a seat on a bench when one of the men vacates, and I share my spot with Gwenna. Kip takes off his shell house and sits atop it, looking bored, as only a Slitherskin can. Meriden bites her nails and casts anxious looks at the door, and I try not to do the same. Are we going to get in trouble because Hawk isn't here, and neither is Magpie? I try to think of a lie to cover for them both. Hawk doesn't need one, but Magpie. Perhaps Magpie has food poisoning. Bad clams, I decide. She got a batch of bad clams and has been vomiting violently for 2 days now. No, there's no need for a guild healer. Or is 2 days of vomiting too much? I lean over toward Gwenna. Exactly how much would you expect to vomit if you ate bad clams? She narrows her eyes at me. Is this some sort of weird innuendo? I bat at her arm. No, I'm thinking of a cover story for Magpie.
Masters Magpie and Crow, please bring your teams to the artifact training hall.
Oh, of course we'd get stuck with Master Crow's team again. I bite back a growl of frustration and get to my feet, smoothing my non-existent skirts. We head through the doors that the other students disappeared into, following behind Master Crow's team of boorish thugs. One of them tries to kick Kip, but the Slitherskin just hops onto the wall and scrambles along it, as if he's completely unbothered by their bullying. I'm busy rehearsing my excuse for Magpie, intent on getting the story straight. And then we're led through a set of double doors and into a room that takes my breath away. It looks like a library, except instead of books upon the shelves, there are trinkets and objects of every kind. As we step inside, I see jewelry boxes and ewers, spoons and blades and flutes. I see a bowl on its side with what look like bright red glyphs written on the belly. I see a few books, a quill, and a variety of other things I can't make out without my spectacles on. I want to squint and examine all of them, but there are people at the far end of the hall staring at us with smirks on their faces.
I am Master Tersel,
the man announces, and his sash glitters just enough that even with my poor sight, I can tell he's important. He's a slender man with a balding head and a blurry face.
Are both teams here, Master Crow?
My men are all here,
he states, stepping forward.
Ready for the challenge.
Before anyone can ask about Magpie, I step forward. All of Magpie's team is here. Hawk is currently on a rescue mission in the tunnels, and Magpie couldn't make it this morning, I blurt out. Clams! Lots of bad clams! Vomit everywhere! Really terrible! Never seen anything that color before, and the smell was just horrific. Master Tersel recoils, raising his hand to stop my babbling.
We don't need the details, thank you.
He looks down the line at us, pausing. Then he straightens and continues.
Very well. Teams, this is an exercise to show off your knowledge of artifacts to Archivist Kestrel. He is not a member of the Guild, but is very important as the official archivist for the Guild itself.
An archivist? Who isn't in the Guild himself, but gets to catalogue and pick through all of the Guild's artifacts? I'm hit with a strong surge of envy. It sounds like the ideal job, and for a moment, I wish I were him. No tunnels, no obstacle courses, no backpacks with rocks. Just sitting inside and enjoying time studying artifacts to learn what we can from old Prell and its ruins.
Our friend has brought several legitimate and no longer functional artifacts here with him today. We've hidden them amongst the training duplicates on the walls here.
He gestures at the laden shelves.
There will be 3 rounds. Each person on each team will select an object and bring it to their team's table. The archivist will give you a point for each correctly identified artifact.
By the end of the game, the team with the most points wins.
Oh, what do we win? Locke calls out.
Honor for your house.
Master Tersel announces in a stiff voice. Locke groans.
I can see it's not much of an incentive for magpie students.
Master Crow says in an infuriating voice.
So I'll sweeten the deal for you. The losers have to do the obstacle course in the rain, and the winners will eat dinner inside.
I'm sold, Gwenna mutters.
Take a moment to discuss strategy and then select the order your team will go in.
Tersel continues. We huddle, our heads together, with Kip in the center of our small group.
We're fucked, Locke whispers. Two of Crow's men are repeaters.
That means they suck, right? Gwenna asks. Locke makes a sound of distress.
You'd think that, but they have an advantage. They'll be familiar with the training artifacts already. They've probably done this several times before.
Meriden looks crushed. I don't think I can do the obstacle course again today.
Gwenna shoots me a warning look, and I know what she's thinking. She wants me to stay quiet, to hide the fact that I know how to read old Prelian glyphs. But I'm with Meriden. If I have to hear Master Crow scream for me to tunnel one more time, I might lose my mind.
I should go first, I tell them. Each round, let me go first.
No, Gwenna begins.
Yes.
My expression is firm. I can see if there's a legitimate artifact and try to get it before they do.
How do you know if it's legit? What, are you some kind of artifact expert?
Locke scoffs. No, but I can read old Prelian, I say. And before I can add on to that, Master Tersel rings a bell. I straighten and move to the front of the line of our group, ignoring the curious looks that Locke is shooting in my direction. When he nods, I step forward for our team, and so does someone for Master Crow's team.
Each of you select one artifact and set it on the table in front of your team, and then someone else in your team will take their turn and select.
I stride forward to the shelves with crisp, authoritative steps, and then move my face a mere handspan away, squinting and examining each thing as best I can. There's a music box, a spoon, a plate, a tool of some kind, a wand, a goblet, a lamp, a ewer. The scatter of objects ranges from the mundane to the fantastical, and all of them are highly ornate in the style of old Prel. My vision is terrible without my spectacles, so I pick up one object and hold it practically to my nose, trying to read the writing painted on the underside of the vase.
Is there a problem, fledgling?
Master Tersel calls out. No, I'm just making sure I don't miss anything, I tell him, and set the vase back down on the shelf. It looked authentic and appropriately old enough, the porcelain surface cracked and crazed. But the tidy writing on the underside was absolute gibberish, mimicking old Prelian glyphs without knowledge of what they mean. It's obviously a fake. I squint my way down the rest of the shelf, looking for obvious issues. Several of the artifacts have a bold yellow paint on them that makes me pause. Prelians crafted their dyes from minerals and foodstuffs, and most of their yellows were murky at best. Blues and reds and earth tones are the colors prominent in old Prelian artifacts, and I pick up a yellow cup and eye the glyphs crawling along the edge. Cup of Neverternal Milks from a Great Pigeon. Yeah, it's a fake. I suspect all of the yellows are fakes, and that helps me rule things out. My opponent picks up an artifact with confidence and returns to his table. And then all eyes are on me, waiting.
Do we need to set a timer, fledgling?
No, I'll pick something. I just don't know what. I eye the next shelf worried, and then spot what looks like an ugly stone-encrusted egg behind a comb and mirror set. I pick the egg up and look for glyphs, as Prelians labeled everything that had a function. Weight of crushing. Charges left, 0. Prelian artifacts with a specific set of charges always have a countdown glyph engraved on them, magically updated as each charge is used. Pursing my lips, I turn the egg over in my hands and then set it back down on the shelf as if it's a fake. I walk toward a series of glassware and pick up a ewer, then say, "Does the artifact need to have charges?"
"What?"
Master Tersel demands, clearly annoyed at the time I'm taking. I turn, facing him with the useless ewer in my grasp. "Does the artifact have to have usable charges, or does it just need to be a legitimate artifact?" He tilts his head and gives me an annoyed look.
"Do you think we would put working artifacts in here?"
I want to say, "I don't know, would you?" Because some artifacts are absolutely useless other than being amusing at parties. Like the only artifact we have at home that still works, a ewer of delicate water. It makes any water it pours have a light floral taste to it, a nod to some spoiled noble's taste preference. But I'm probably not supposed to know that, and everyone's staring at me with resentment. I put the pitcher back, intending to head back for the egg when I see the perfect solution. It's a small bowl with a glyph on the metal lip and a pretty red enamel on the edges and the two fluted handles. I recognize that bowl because my mother gave one to my grandmother long ago. It's a bowl of infinite olives, another kitchenware nod to some old Prelian nobility who couldn't be bothered to make their own snacks. I snatch it up, glance at the bottom to confirm that it is indeed a bowl of infinite olives, and then return to my table proudly.
"Finally,"
Master Tersel says.
"Next up, choose your artifact."
Locke heads out for our team, and as she does, I cough and cover my mouth, bending over. As I do, I whisper, "Don't pick anything with yellow on it. They're fakes." "How do you know?" Meriden whispers back. Gwenna grabs her hand and squeezes it, then gives Kip a meaningful look. "Just listen to her, all right? She knows what she's doing." Her gaze moves to Lark, who has a bright yellow flute she's bringing back to the table, and purses her lips. I try not to wince, because everyone knows that wind instruments weren't popular in Old Prel. It was in the Mansa Wars several centuries ago that flutes became popular in music. But no one's perfect. I manage to keep a straight face as Gwenna picks up a knitting hook of some kind that has the Domin sign on it. The one of the bird with its wings spread that is a favorite of forgers everywhere. She wouldn't know, so I'm not going to judge her. Kip picks a delicate knife and Meriden chooses something that looks like a clasp, and then all the artifacts have been chosen for our team. Master Tersel and Archivist Kestrel stroll past our table, picking up each item and then setting it aside.
"Fake,"
Tersel declares loudly as he picks up Lark's object.
"Fake,"
he says to Kip's blade.
"Real,"
to Meriden's clasp, and she lets out a gasp of pure delight.
"Fake,"
to Gwenna's knitting hook. He pauses and eyes my bowl, then looks over at his companion. Archivist Kestrel nods sagely.
"Real,"
Master Tersel says in a sour voice.
2 points for Master Magpie's team.
I grab Lark's hand with excitement, and I'm pretty sure Kip's tail curls around my boot with delight. 2 points is good, considering our team has never gone over the finer points of forgery, or even the less fine points of forgery, or any points at all, really. The points are tallied for Master Crow's team, and they only have one artifact declared real.
1 point for Master Crow's fledglings. Let us begin round two. Fledglings, please come and choose.
Master Crow looks like he could spit nails, glaring at me as I get to my feet. I smooth sweaty hands down the front of my pants and wonder if I need to get a fake this time to seem as if I'm like everyone else, or if I want to score points for my team. I debate this mentally as I continue down the long row of packed shelves. To my surprise, the man opposite me hurries over to the ewer I'd held last round, the one when I'd asked if items needed charges, and snatches it up. Too late for hiding under the radar, I suspect. Everything I touch now will come under scrutiny, I realize. They're all watching my every pause to read glyphs, my every hesitation in front of an object. I need to go back to the egg from before, but as I turn around, I see a thick palm-sized disc on a chain, the metal tarnished and scuffed. It has glyphs at 4 equal points.